Thank you very much for that warm welcome, Rhonda. And I must begin, of course, in paying my respects to the members of the Kulin Nation and to thank Joy for her warm welcome to country yesterday. It is proper that we acknowledge the fact that we are on the different lands of the different Aboriginal groups when we travel to different parts of Australia, because we have never forgotten that our people lived here for 60,000 years before the British arrived in 1788. And in fact, in those days, Australia was a truly livable place for our people. So how come in 220 years we have been utterly dispossessed, utterly denigrated, utterly discriminated against, utterly marginalised, and we are now among the poorest, the least educated, the unhealthiest, the most unemployed, the most imprisoned in pro rata terms, and the list goes on. Time is up. We can no longer call ourselves a First Nation state with the economy booming and leave the plight of Indigenous peoples, the original owners who so generously gave up their lands with a struggle, but by no means with the power to defeat the colonisers, for which we have never been compensated, and for which there is much unfinished business to deal with. Time is up. The time for governments to impose solutions is no longer acceptable. I want to tell you a little bit about myself. I was born and raised in Alice Springs. My father was an Urundi man who died when I was 11. My mother is a Gadangi woman from the top end of the Northern Territory. I had three Aboriginal grandparents and one white grandfather. And the only thing I inherited from the latter was his surname. The experience of my family has been similar to most other Aboriginal people in this country. My mother was 8 years old when the policeman rode into the family community where they lived and decided that my mother, Emma, and her sister Kate, at 8 and 7 years old respectively, had to go to school and that he would take them. As far as we can work out, that was in 1933, and no effort was ever made by the authorities to reunite my mother with her parents. And in fact, her father died before she saw him again. Well, she never saw him again. Her sister died, never to see her parents again. All of the boys were taken the following year and put on Garden Point. My mother went to Carlin Compound in Darwin. We traced my mother's mother when my brother worked at Social Security and went through all the microfiche records, and I, which he wasn't supposed to do, and found my grandmother and where she lived, because she was then on an age pension. So to be sure, in Christmas 1978, Boxing Day, we hired a car from Alice Springs and we drove to Borroloola, where we thought she was. And they said, no, she's not there. We left Mum at home. We didn't tell Mum what we were doing. No, she's not here. She's at Tanumbrini. So we drove back to Tanumbrini. And if you know these distances, I'm talking several thousand kilometres. So we drove back to Tanumbrini, and when we arrived, She was sitting outside this little tin shanty with one of my uncles, who in fact was a babe in arms when he was taken away. Now, that was the first time he'd seen his mother in late 78, Christmas 78, from a babe in arms. And the following year, in March, we stayed there with Nana. You know, he said to her when we jumped out of the car, "Oh, that's Emma's kids." And she, you know, she was a tiny little woman, and she came up, and there were three of us, and we're all giants. And she embraced us, and we cried, and we got to know her. I was very angry as a young woman growing up in this country that I didn't know my parents' parents. I knew my father's mother, Hetty Perkins, because she lived across the road from us, but I didn't know my mother's people. So I was denied that as a result of the abhorrent policies of assimilation, for which, give him his due, the new Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd, has now apologised to the stolen generations and their families that were affected. So it doesn't matter how successful I may have been in my life, I still carry the grief of the denial of my rights to my family, my culture, and my heritage, and my language. I'm getting over the angry bit, but I'm still sad that I was not able to exercise my rights in relation to enjoying my cultural heritage to the extent that I would have liked to. Now, having been born and raised in Alice Springs and the niece of the late Charles Perkins, I was very aware of the situation facing our people across the country from a very young age. At 14 years old, I was handing out how to vote cards for Aboriginal candidates standing for elections. I went to my first Fakatsi meeting when I was 14 years old. I attended Aboriginal Progress Association meetings when I was at secondary school in Adelaide in the 60s. In fact, the 60s for me, growing up as a young woman in my teens, was a very exciting time of social change, not only in Australia, but in other parts of the world. 1960s, you saw the civil rights movement, which inspired many of us to do the same here in Australia. We had the anti-Vietnam wars, we had the women's movement, we had all these calls for social change for the better. People took to the streets, they got organised at the local level, and they stood up. And so were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples doing that. There was a 10-year campaign by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples with their white supporters to bring about the 1967 referendum. Why was that necessary? It was necessary because there was entrenched in the Constitution of Australia, a clause that prevented the Commonwealth Government from legislating for Aboriginal people. Section 5126 said that the Commonwealth had the power to make laws for people of any race except Aboriginals. And Section 127, which was repealed in the 67 referendum, said, in the reckoning of the population, Aboriginals shall not be counted. Now, a lot of people think that the 67 referendum gave us the right to vote and the right to be counted in the census. In fact, it's a myth. What the 67 referendum did was give the Commonwealth the power to legislate on behalf of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. That's it. And it removed the clause about the reckoning of the population, which is not only to do with the census, but was also to do with how to distribute the electorates and how, and in those days, in the Commonwealth funding arrangements, the population count was important in terms of determining the distribution of money to the states. So, indeed, 67 was a big turning point. But remember the policies that preceded that as far as they went for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. After the initial annihilation and dispossession of lands, the poisonings, the hangings, the killings, all of the massacres and the nasty, you know, treatment of my people that went on, we then had soothe the dying pillow. They're all going to die out, so let's put them all onto missions and let's control their movements and let's just, you know, let them die out eventually. Well, of course, that didn't happen. Then we had the assimilation policies, which led to the Stolen Generations. And then, in 1971, following the 67 referendum, and the fact that the states were putting pressure on the Commonwealth to provide more money for Aboriginal services and Torres Strait Islander services across the country, the Commonwealth started to act. A Liberal minister denounced the assimilation policy in 1971 and adopted the policy of self-determination, providing it was done on the terms that government thought it needed to be done. I've worked in government for over 30 years. 21 years in Canberra in the senior executive service, 17 of those years at deputy secretary level and above. I've had a lot of experience in dealing across bureaucracy, in dealing with governments at every level in this country. In my experience, never, ever has any one government ever had the backbone to commit the resources required to redress the disadvantage suffered by my people on a daily basis. I do not need to tell you what the statistics are in relation to how much the gap has to be closed. Housing, billions of dollars of investment required. Why do we have such deplorable overcrowding? Why does every new government that gets elected come up with a new way that they want to deal with the Aboriginal problem? It's not our problem. We are disadvantaged. We are marginalised. We are poor. We do not have the numbers to influence government to the extent that others do. But we keep on trying. Why do governments have to impose rather than negotiate? All government policy is empty if it is not, in my view, guided by principle. In my experience, in starting in the public service in 1979, which, remember, the first Department of Aboriginal Affairs established at the federal level was in 1972. By the Whitlam government. And what it enabled us to do was to fund community-controlled and community-based Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations to fill the service delivery gap because our people could not get access to the full range of services available to other Australians. It is very important to remember that. We almost set up an Aboriginal public sector through the funding of those NGOs. But we were very clear that they were community controlled and community based, and that they knew how to provide the services more effectively than mainstream to our people, because they were culturally attuned, they were culturally appropriate, and people used them at the right time when they needed them. I always argued as a public servant that the investment of public monies, particularly at the state level, was at the negative end of the socioeconomic scale. What the dollars were paying for was the overrepresentation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in hospital, in prisons, in juvenile detention centres, and so on. In my view, many of those programs don't work. They don't bring about the responsible change for individuals that need to be brought about. In terms of the hospitalisation, the over-hospitalisation of Aboriginal people, that could have easily been prevented with ready access to primary health care in communities. And the attitudes that we had to contend with were such as Charlie Court, when he was the Premier of Western Australia, and we found the money to fund the Aboriginal Medical Service in Broome. And Charlie Court's response as the Premier of Western Australia to our announcement of funding the AMS in Broome was, they are setting up a terrorist organisation. It was to provide basic primary health care. Nothing more, nothing less. So there were a lot of attitudes held by very powerful people in this country that were ill-informed, ignorant, and misplaced. The way to overcome that is for governments to adopt principles. And the principles that I want to see in place are recognition, rights, and reform. Governments can no longer do as they please when it comes to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in this country. They have to be fully engaged and negotiate with Aboriginal leaders. They have, if you saw Four Corners last night on education on Bathurst Island, you'll see that the view is that no matter what you do, it doesn't work. Well, that's not true. If you give Aboriginal people full control and true self-determination with the resources to buy in the expertise they want, to develop the expertise within their own people, you will see the changes. You cannot do it. NGOs can't do it by themselves. Governments can't do it by themselves. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people can't do it by themselves. But Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people must have the right to negotiate the future and how the pathway will be pursued. In my over 30 years of working in government, not only from 1979 in Canberra, but prior to that I worked for the Commonwealth in the old Native Affairs Department. In fact, it was a branch that was under the Department of Interior in the late 60s and early 70s in Alice Springs. And I started off there as the switchboard operator, you know, the old plug-in switchboards. And one day, a person came into the office and wanted to see one of the bosses. So I went down to the boss and I said, there's a man here to see you. And he said to me, is he black or white? And I was a young, you know, person. And I said, what the effing difference does that make? And he said, all right, I'll see him. So I went back out and I got the man and I took him in. And of course, he was Aboriginal, but, you know, I was so angry that the boss even had the audacity to ask me that. Anyway, I got moved off reception and ended up the CEO. I have to say that in all my years of working in the government, nothing was easy, right? No matter what promotion you got, you only got it because you were black and a woman. You know, didn't matter how hard you worked, didn't matter anyway, I didn't care, right? But the personal sort of experience wasn't as bad as what I felt was the indifference that I encountered among my colleagues in other departments. Because once the Department of Aboriginal Affairs was established, remembering the Commonwealth had no involvement across the breadth of Australia in Aboriginal Affairs until after the 67 referendum, and when Gough Whitlam set the department up in 72, they had to negotiate with the states, and they set up these very grey-worded agreements between the Commonwealth and states as to who was going to do what. And of course, every time you had a meeting with state officials, you argued about the content of the agreements, that, and you could interpret it whichever way you liked, depending on what side of the fence you sat on. But we've experienced many broken promises. You remember Bob Hawke said, no child will live in poverty. Well, our kids still are. You remember Bob Hawke promised us a treaty at Barunga. We still have no treaty. Probably not known so well publicly, but when the Mabo decision was handed down by the High Court, just give me a tingle when I've got a couple of minutes to go. The Keating government said it would respond in three ways. One, it would implement native title legislation to give effect to the High Court's decision. Two, it would set up the Indigenous Land Corporation to buy back land that could no longer be claimed under native title because native title had been extinguished by the other land administration leases and so on that had evolved over the, you know, period since 1788. And the third one was that there would be a social justice package. Now, I was the CEO of ATSIC, and we had to undertake a nationwide consultative process with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And we produced a report called Recognition, Rights and Reform. And it identified Indigenous specific rights. It identified the rights, the human rights and civil rights and other rights that Australians enjoy. It wanted the recognition of the fact that Aboriginal people had been here for 60,000 years and had some legitimate place in this nation, and in fact to destroy the oldest living culture in the world would be a bigger blight on Australia than it would to have embraced it and have it at the core of our Australian heritage, and reform, how to change the nature of engagement and service delivery and closing the gap. You know what we got? One recommendation was accepted and adopted by the Keating government. And you know what that was? The official recognition of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flag. That was it. Nothing more. When the Howard government came to power in 1996, the first thing they did was cut $480 million out of the ATSIC budget. Why did they do that? Because they were cost-cutting across the service and blacks weren't going to be exempt. Doesn't matter about the need. Do you know what programs got cut? The programs for families, women and children in Aboriginal communities. We never recouped the money, ever. In last year's dollars, that would have equated to something like $800 million that we lost back in 96. That was money that was going directly into Aboriginal communities. These are the sort of trials and tribulations driven by ideological, you know, pursuits rather than good public policy. The most abhorrent public policy for Aboriginal people over the last few years was the so-called national emergency response, causing the so-called Northern Territory intervention in 72 Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. I was very outspoken against that move by the government when Mal Brough and John Howard announced it last year. Just before the election, you know, we might be losing, let's drag out another issue, let's use wedge politics, whatever. I could not believe it when Kevin Rudd agreed to go along with it. I could not believe it. I thought, my God, don't do this Me Too stuff, Kevin, right? Just to get over the line. Everybody wants a change, let's make it happen for the better, you know? But what happened with the Northern Territory intervention? And they're rolling out the income quarantining. You know what they did in the Northern Territory? They suspended the operations of the Racial Discrimination Act and they cut the operation, they ceased the operation of the Community Development Employment Program, which was in fact a Work for the Dole program that had operated for 30 years, over 30 years, in Aboriginal communities and Torres Strait Islander communities around the country. And the reason they cut CDEP was that they couldn't quarantine Social Security. They couldn't quarantine CDEP, so they had to abolish it so they could quarantine Centrelink payments, right? And what they did was effectively suspend the operations of the RDA and argue what they were doing was a special measure. Now, we still don't believe that it was a special measure eligible under the RDA, right? It wasn't. And we're going to contest that legally still, because the point has to be shown. Three times since the implementation of the Racial Discrimination Act, three times its operations have been suspended, and three times it's been about my people. The first case was a women's sacred site versus the building of a bridge at home at Hindmarsh Island in South Australia. It wasn't about what was right or wrong in that, but that's a whole other story which I haven't got time to go through. The fact of the matter is that in order for that bridge to get built, they suspended the operations of the RDA, right? The second time they did it was in the WIC case for the WIC people. And the third time they did it was for the Northern Territory intervention. So when my people, who many of them were, you know, taught me about the history of our people and the history of politics and engagement with governments and so on, who campaigned for the 67 referendum, would have been horrified in that they thought by giving the Commonwealth the power to legislate on behalf of Aboriginal people, that they would only legislate in a positive way, for a positive outcome. And I think probably most Australians thought that as well. But the fact of the matter is, it has now shown, right, that it can be used against the interest of a particular racial group. Okay. So what do we need to do about that? We need a Bill of Rights. We need a renewed constitution. We need to be a republic, and we need to have recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the first peoples of this nation, our status entrenched in the Australian Constitution. The government needs to get serious about what you might call a futures fund to overcome the plight of my people in this country. It is a blight on the nation if the gap is not closed. It is a blight. on every single Australian and every single government. It's not our blight, it's everyone's blight. We're the victims. Don't blame us. Take a good, hard look at yourselves and what you can do to make a difference. I want to finish on the principle of engagement. I was at the 2020 summit with 1,000 others, or 999, and it was a privilege, actually, to be there. Despite some of the negative publicity and whatever afterwards and the hurried nature of the report backs at the plenary sessions, the actual experience was very good. And I think it was welcomed and by the people who were there, because at long last, after this cloak of 10 years of fear being thrown over the country, don't speak out, say anything against them ideologically, otherwise you're banned for life, you're blacklisted, people had a chance to have a say. People had a chance to put forward ideas. Now, in the group that I was in the Indigenous group, there were many things that came out. But fundamentally, we said three things. Recognition, formal recognition of the status of our people. Entrench it in the Constitution and make a treaty. Treaty is nothing to be frightened of. All a treaty is a formal agreement between two parties that sets out the relationship and the roles and responsibilities of each. That's it. No big deal. You know, they've had one in New Zealand for, you know, what, hundreds of years. They get on. You know, they're making changes for the better. So are American Indians and Canadians. You know, why is it such a dirty word? Don't treat it as a dirty word. Promote it. It needs to happen. Recognition rights, in terms of Indigenous-specific rights. You know, stop all the whinging about whether Aboriginal kids get secondary grants or study grants or scholarships. We need them. You know, we're poor. Our kids break the law so they can get into a juvenile detention centre to get new clothes because the families can't provide for them. That is an indictment on society. You know, let's get real about what the rights are. A right to decent housing, a right to decent healthcare, a right to be able to live in a functional community, a right for kids to have proper schooling. You know, what's his name? Bill Heffernan and I had a big row up in Canberra last year about schools in the Northern Territory. You know, they did a report, right? The government, Northern Territory government commissioned this report by CAPER to look at the spending on Aboriginal education from money that was given specifically by the Commonwealth to the Northern Territory for Aboriginal education. Out of every dollar that was given, 47 cents, which was a revised figure after the Treasury went ballistic, because the first report that John Taylor put out was 33 cents in the dollar, the second report that was revised after Treasury, you know, went ballistic was 47 cents in the dollar. They still got shortchanged by, 53 cents in every Aboriginal community in terms of... Where did the other 53 cents go in the dollar? Into schools in Darwin, because that's where the bulk of the electorates were. I mean, that is outrageous. So Bill Heffernan comes up to me, you know, that Liberal bloke in the Parliament, and he says to me, you know, you're wrong about all this, you know, Pat. He said, we've just built a new high school at Wadaya. I said, well, good on you, mate, not before bloody time. And so I went over to see some of the people who were with us from Wadaya, and I said, what's the go with this new school at Wadaya? They said, oh, yeah, the building's there, but there's no furniture or teachers or anything else. So, you know, don't believe everything that politicians tell you about what a great job they're doing, because, you know, most of it's just to get reflected in the media. Let me turn in closing to why, in fact, when I left the public service in 2006, I primarily left for family reasons, personal reasons, besides the fact I couldn't stand it a minute longer. I mean, I had dedicated my life. I was a bloody good public servant and I worked hard and I was determined to make a difference for the benefit of my people. Absolutely determined that Aboriginal, that I could influence as many decision makers as possible to support Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people getting out of the miserable situations we've been relegated to. And I went home to retire and to look after, took my mum with me, who lives with me and has for over 20 years, you know, another carer, because she's getting old and she wanted to go home. You know, that's what they do. They want to go back, you know, to country. They don't want to die or other places, you know. And so I went home to look after her, and I was home for less than a month, 2 weeks, in fact, and I got the phone call to say, can you come and project manage this NITV for a couple of months until we find a CEO? And, of course, the rest is history. I haven't stopped moving or working since, and it's a seven-day-a-week job. Now, what happened was I fully intended only to work for a couple of months until they got a new CEO. And I went down to Sydney for 3 weeks to do a handover with the lady that was moving on from the secretariat. And I realised in that short time what a wonderful potential this was. Pay black time. You know, have your own television service, for God's sake, you know. Just imagine what we can do. And are we going to do it? Right? I took until the 21st of May to bring one of the 20 staff that I had on board. I brought my head of television on the 5th of March, and on the 13th of July, we were on air. 19 weeks. Unbelievable record time. We now, we went direct to the bush, beaming in the bush. We use Impaja's second channel, because we have to, the government said, to beam, to transmit. It goes direct to home satellites anywhere in Australia, if you point it in the right direction and you've got one. And it goes to all the communities, what they call the remote Indigenous Broadcasting Service communities, 160-odd of them that have transmitters in the local area. They got it from the 13th of July. Other people got it on pay TV, Foxtel, on Channel 180 from the 1st of November last year. No one believed we would ever do it, especially governments, you know. But I've been determined to demonstrate the increase in audience reach to impress upon government the need to continue to fund NITV and to continue to see its value. I've now got it on the Parliamentary House Network in Canberra, one of four, I think, or six, which is very good. And I'm very proud about that, and soon it'll be in Ballarat or Geelong and Canberra on Transact and so on. So we're spreading all the time. We do have an agreement here with Channel 31, which we pay them $6,000 to broadcast the Marngrook football show on Thursday nights, because everyone in Melbourne's so mad about football. It's a wonderful show if you haven't seen it. But that's the only agreement that we have with the community TV people at this stage. My aim for NITV is to be free to air across Australia into every lounge room and office or whatever, community centre, for all Australians to see. And the reason I realised the potential of this was because people really need to see what our television service is for, by, and about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people themselves, right? We're producing a small news program at the moment. I want to make our news service the most trusted source of news for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So if you want to get the alternative view from the sensationalist rubbish that's carried on the other networks, watch NITV news. We'll be increasing that as resources permit. But to get our television service into the hearts and minds of people in lounge rooms and schools, through Austar, we're on Foxtel and Austar, and through Austar we're on their schools program as well. To get in will cause a much better, or I hope, result in a much better understanding and appreciation of the richness of our cultural heritage that has survived despite everything that's happened, and why it should be at the core of our Australian heritage, and why our people should be embraced and able to enjoy their, not only their rights, but a decent quality of life. So I believe NITV has an enormous potential, and even though it's the lowest paid job I've had for many, many years, I'm very proud to be a part of it. And on that note, I'll finish. Thank you.